On today's edition of the College Basketball Power Hour, the powers that have been in college basketball, not necessarily powers anymore. Plus, the deepest, most parody-ridden women's college basketball that we have seen in a long time, who is at the top, both in teams and individually, all of that, plus so much more. We'll talk to you soon. Welcome in to the College Basketball Power Hour. That's right. If you missed last week, we're a basketball podcast now. That's Ice Young. He's Jason Fitz. I am Caroline Fenton. And the world of college basketball is just like the gift that keeps on giving. We had Nate Oates break in a clipboard. We had Duke absolutely obliterate Illinois. I mean, like, they have families, Cooper Flag and Duke. My goodness. Fitz, Ice, how we doing?
I mean, we're doing better than those families you just mentioned like that. There were some, and look, guys, we're going to get into this for the whole show, but there were some, I think, big results this weekend in the sense that we're trying to figure out who's who. And to me, I watched over the weekend and I was reminded of this one thing. Like, we always say this on the football side too. Like, the sport takes care of itself. Over time, like, we're trying to figure out, is this team good? Is this team bad? And fans yell so much about the reaction. Like, you're not giving us enough love, or you're giving them too much credit. Over the course of the season, we see weekends like last weekend, and I'm reminded, yeah, you know, the cream separates, and there's a reason that we go through this whole process.
Oh, my gosh. It's the reason why, like, it's the best time of the year, because you know that the teams that are succeeding now have really, like, gone through the mud, have really weathered all the storms, and are still remaining consistent, or they're getting better at this time. I think especially, like, I don't know, on the men's side, I think we're seeing teams who were maybe top 10 for a majority of the season, and that now we're kind of looking like, I don't know if you belong in the top 10. I'm not sure if you should stay there. And then there are teams that have been kind of inconsistent that for the last four or five games have really made a very strong push. I mean, this is the 2 weeks in basketball where you want to be playing your best basketball. I often say you don't want to be doing it too early in January and February, because then people figure you out. But at this point in the season, we're starting to see, like you said, Jason, the cream rise to the top.
Yeah, and I think something you just said there is really important. Like, with me, when I think a top 10 team, I don't really give a damn about the actual top 10. Like, when I say this is a top 10 team, I'm not sitting there with my notepad and being like, well, who's number one, who's number two? There's a feel to a top 10 team. To me, a top 10 team is a team that you know any given night can beat anybody, that you know consistently is going to be in the championship caliber conversation, that you know has the perimeter play and the defensive play that they're going to have, that they can get tough buckets when they need to get them. Like, there is an identity to what a top 10 team looks like. And I'm with you, because there are some teams right now that are sitting between 8 and 13 that we sit around. I'm like, man, I don't know if I think of that as really a top 10 team. Like, that's got to sort itself out.
And I think that's different on the men's and the women's side. Because on the men's side, you know, we always say March is for contenders. I think you could say maybe January is for pretenders. And maybe February is separating those pretenders from those contenders, from the teams that we feel like we really need to watch in March. I think that they're on the men's side, it fluctuates. Like, I thought that I had Tennessee all figured out, that they were a defensive team that I couldn't really trust in March because they just can't score enough. And then they go on the road at Texas A&M, another top 10 team, and Chaz Lanier, a player who struggled, frankly, throughout conference play to put up big numbers, drops 30 and is, I think, 8 for 10 from 3 or 10 for 13, whatever his final numbers were. I thought, okay, I thought I had Tennessee all figured out. Now they're all of a sudden this offensive juggernaut. I thought I had Alabama figured out, but then they kind of drop an egg at Missouri and then go on the road at Kentucky and get a massive win. It's like all of these things that I thought we had figured out in the men's game, there's now this glob in the top 10 where I'm trying to figure out, okay, like, what are you this week? Who are you going to be in March? Whereas on the other hand, on the women's side, there's 15 teams that I think are deserving of being top 5 teams. And there's just been a constant kind of rotation at the top. And we'll get into all of that. But with all of this discussion, that can kind of bring us to one thing that we learned this past week. Fitz, we'll start with you. One thing that you learned.
Yeah, UConn ain't it. And look, like, here's a teaser. We're going to talk to, I talked to Alex Caravan and asked him a lot of tough questions. You'll hear that later in the show. But I mean, we all, look, there are certain moments in college basketball when you're playing at the Garden, like, it just means something different. It hits different. I've gone to some of these UConn games that are down at the Garden. So I had big expectations for UConn taking on St. John's at the Garden. And by halftime, you knew where this game was headed. This is not the UConn team of the last 2 years. And the problem is we're going to get into the tournament and everybody's going to say, well, you don't want to face UConn. Because they're going to inevitably, I think they're going to get into this thing. But they're going to say, no, that experience, you don't want to take them on. They're going to turn it on. And what we watched over the weekend was that they don't have that experience. We have to acknowledge that their leadership council has changed so much. The guys they're leaning on, like Alex Caravan, who struggled a lot over the last month and a half, like the guys they need to be rocks don't look like they're rocks. And the young guys aren't developing as fast as they could. So like this takes nothing against Hurley and UConn, but there has to be a point where you look at it and say, I don't care about your resume. I care about you right now. And the right now of UConn does not look like they're a threat to even make it to the Sweet 16 at this point. Like, this is not the UConn of the last 2 years, Ice.
I totally agree. You know, your point about the leadership is so important this time of year because it's often the more experienced teams or the more mature teams that are able to pull out those tough games. The thing, too, with UConn, you know, this year has been some of the injuries have really been tough on them. I mean, the time that they lost Liam McNeely, who was leading them in scoring and really starting to emerge as that freshman, almost really like playing like a sophomore sensation, but then he went out. And so then it was like they had to figure out ways to win and play without him for a couple of games. And then Alex Caravan, I can't imagine how much pressure has been on him with all the players that the Huskies lost last year for him to step up and be that force from a leadership standpoint on the court and being consistent. He's went through shooting slumps. So I just think they've had some other challenges that come with a basketball season that maybe we haven't seen the Huskies face in the last 2 years, right? And so, I mean, it happens. The other thing is, we talked about this last year, like, the target is on your back. It's quadruple the size now. So other teams don't care. Like, you are the team to beat no matter your top 10 or your top 50, or you're out of the top 50, which they might be by the time we get to this tournament.
Yeah. No, and by the way, I think this year's struggles weirdly make last year even more impressive because we 100%. Weren't sure if last year was going to be like a transition year. And then we're reminded, no, like what they did last year was just damn special. Like it was special. Yeah. And that like the fact that we expected that, not we on this show, but we as a general society expected that to just suddenly be the case again this year. It speaks to how difficult it is. And it speaks to how special last year was for them.
And UConn as a whole, obviously, as you said, has not looked like the UConn of old. But I'll look at that St. John's and UConn matchup just kind of under a microscope. You know, St. John's has been nearly unbeatable at the Garden. When they're at home, they look like a completely different team, or a completely unbeatable team, rather. UConn got swept by St. John's this past season. I have been going back and forth with this. Does that say more about UConn and the struggles this season, how hard it is to rebuild and to reload? Or does that say more about St. John's? Like, obviously, UConn is going to dominate the conversation, back-to-back national champions. It's the focus of so many conversations that we're going to have in this sport. But are we selling St. John's short for what they are able to do so far this season?
Yeah, I don't think you can sell Rick Pitino short. You know, I just think everybody in the basketball world knew that eventually his teams would be back to being top 10 teams in the country, and probably in 2 years, Final Four contenders. And let me say this, too. The way in which they're doing it is spectacular. I mean, they're not a great offensive team, yet they win basketball games consistently. Like, I think it's really cool the different ways that they've won games. But you talk about that UConn game. They did all the things that they needed to do. 24 points off turnovers. 23 second chance points. 14 bench points. I mean, that's been a calling card for them. I've said this a couple of times on CBS Studio that St. John's didn't really have a bench. They didn't really have depth. But 14 points off the bench isn't terrible. In fact, come tournament time with a team that is very good defensively, that might be all that you need. And so I think you have to give St. John's and Rick Pitino their nod and make them a very dangerous team in the tournament to do some things that maybe we don't expect because they have been battle tested in the Big East this season. And Jason, I don't know how you feel, but I feel like they've passed the test.
Oh yeah, and I found myself watching that game thinking, man, we started the show talking about who you trust, who's a top 10 team, and you think about some of the teams that have been hanging out in that, the A&M, a team we've already talked about, Iowa State, a team that has had some up and downs, and I look at those and I watch the way St. John's playing, and I'm thinking, man, There is something about St. John's. It feels to me like they're going to get into the tournament. They're going to be able to make things ugly. They're going to be able to muck it up. And they've got one of the best coaches in college basketball history. It means something there. So I think right now we're seeing this ascension. Like right now, today, it feels like everybody's sleeping on St. John's a little bit. In a couple of weeks, that conversation is going to be loud. It's going to be loud and it's going to be different because Patino's got him firing. And it's interesting, Ice, because we've talked about all the perimeter play and all the guard play and everything that you need in the tournament. I also think the outlier to that is like, all right, we may not have some of those offensive things, but we can disrupt you to the point that you can't even inbounds the ball comfortably. Like that is just, that is who they are and what they do. I think that's going to be a calling card.
Yeah. I'll say too, I've been talking to some New Yorkers about St. John's and just chatting basketball. And it almost feels like when the Knicks were good last season and how just the whole city of New York is behind them. I also think St. John's has that. Whole freaking city is behind Rick Pitino and the Red Storm. And that means a difference too in March because you need fans to travel. You need people to be there. You need that 11th man kind of energy. And I think they've got that too.
Yeah, you don't want, like, look at those locations for the second round. I was looking at this over the weekend. If somehow St. John's ends up in Providence, you don't want that smoke. Because the entire city of New York's just going to be like, we're headed up.
It's over. Yeah.
And there are going to be, you know, the fraction of the college basketball fan base that doesn't really pay attention until conference championships and until March and the NCAA tournament that haven't really paid attention to what's happening in the regular season. And if that's you, that's fine. There's no shame in that game. But there is going to be a group of people that are so surprised by what I think St. John's can do in the tournament. They're going to be thinking, these little Johnnies, the Johnnies doing what I think they're able of achieving in the NCAA tournament. I think there's going to be some people surprised. Rightfully so or not rightfully so, we can debate that by depending on who they're or based off of who their head coach is, but some people that are awfully surprised by what St. John's can do in March. Ice, what did you learn?
Okay, I learned this week that Michigan State is a top 10 team. Jason and I were talking about games to watch last week, and I think I had highlighted Michigan State and Michigan. I love a good rivalry game. I've got another rivalry game to highlight this week that we'll get into later. But, I mean, Tom Izzo's squad went and beat Purdue, a top 15 team at home, and then went on the road at Michigan and beat another top 15 team on the road. That is a tough stretch, especially in conference play, especially at the end of February. And I feel like they looked calm, cool, and collected as I watched the clips back of those games. I think that they're battle-tested and ready for March. I feel like I use the term battle-tested all the time, but for me, that's what I'm looking for as an analyst. Like, I care if you have played games where you've had to win in different ways, win it ugly, win it pretty, and then I also care if you've dominated some games that maybe we didn't think you should have, because that also passes the eye test in March. But I like the Spartans right now.
Yeah, look, I have my popcorn out. Friday night basketball is my new favorite obsession. And I watched Michigan State never even blink at Michigan. Mm. And that environment, man, that environment was fired up. And that's like, I'm that guy. I love having this is like too much overshare for the world, but I take my Sonos speakers, right? And my TV, it connects to all the Sonos in the house. So whenever I'm watching sports, I turn the volume up and I put it in every speaker. So whichever room I walk to, I still have the crowd noise going. I just love this, like how I watch sports. And like from the tip of that game, there was so much just adrenaline for Michigan, and Sparty didn't care. Like there was a calm, cool collect to them in that environment that I thought was incredible. Now, I'm still concerned about their outside shooting. I will be concerned about their outside shooting for the rest of the time. But they kicked the snot out of them. And I just watched that and thought, man, playing the right way, the right time. Like I think weirdly, everything got so easy for Sparty. That little losing streak for a week and a half where it just everything felt a little unsettled. You mentioned battle tested. That's the thing that they've come out of the other side of that with a calm to what they're doing that I'm with you. I think Sparty has proven week in and week out right now. I mean, this seems to be a theme. Can you make things ugly? Can you play on both ends of the floor? And do you have an epic head coach? Because if you do, you got a shot at the Natty.
Hey, they went up 6 spots in the AP poll. I mean, I think that tied for the biggest jump this week. And I think it was well-deserved.
I think that the NCAA tournament is such a unique one, and it's so uniquely difficult, and there's such a big trust factor, in my opinion, of what teams can you trust in March. It's not just about the teams that are good or the teams that necessarily have a superstar. It's the teams that you can trust. And so much of that trust comes from being battle tested of, oh, I've seen this team do this. I've seen this team in a really tough environment against really good teams with their backs against the wall and either dominate or come back after a halftime deficit. I think that's why I feel so confident about Auburn, is because they've gone through the gauntlet of how difficult the SEC has been this season. It's why I feel so encouraged about Duke. Not necessarily because the ACC has been a gauntlet, but out of conference, Duke has played such difficult opponents, Auburn being one of them. I think Michigan State is the same thing, that we feel like we can trust them in March because they've been there before, because they have veteran presences, and because they have gone through such a difficult gauntlet. And March, obviously, going to be difficult for everyone. Who has the most endurance and who can kind of stand up in some of these tough environments, I think, is such a big part of the trust factor. But for me, in terms of one thing that I learned, I'll go to the women's side. I think I learned that no one's safe. Like in women's Nobody. College basketball, no one is safe. We may have more parity this year than we have ever seen, or at least that we have seen in a really long time. We talked about it last week. UCLA fell to USC on the road, so Notre Dame took over that number one spot. And we wanted to see how Notre Dame was able to kind of respond to being that number one team in the country, to now being the one that everyone wanted to beat, to being the hunted rather than the hunter. And they lost to NC State, a very good NC State team, granted, who is now a top 10 team in the country, a top 15 team going into that matchup. Notre Dame falls. Now Texas is the number one team in the land. But if you go down into the rankings in women's college basketball, Texas, the number one team in the country, legitimate national title contender, UCLA, Notre Dame, USC, UConn, South Carolina, LSU, North Carolina, NC State, Tennessee, legitimate national title contenders, that we're going into the top 15, even outside of the top five, outside of the top 10, and you are still finding legitimate national title contenders. So the parity that we are seeing in the women's game with a USC UCLA top 10 matchup coming up this week, and we'll get into that. But it has been so fun to watch the parity. And it's going to be so interesting to see kind of the cream rise to the top in March on the women's side of the game, Ice.
Yeah, honestly, at this point, everybody's beat everybody. That's also what I love right now about maybe the top seven teams, is that they've played each other, whether it's been conference play, whether it's been non-conference games with, you know, UConn and South Carolina notorious for doing out of conference. But these teams have played each other. So we're actually seeing measuring sticks every other week of how do these top five teams compare against each other. Texas right now has a number one seed. It may not be for long. I think they have the easiest time to finish their conference play regular season. And then, you know, the SEC and ACC tournaments, I think both will be extremely competitive, not to mention the Big Ten. I mean, I don't know if you guys pay attention to the Big Ten, but USC has tough games left and right. Like, UCLA just had to beat Iowa the other day by 2 to 3 points. Like, these teams aren't just skating through conference play either. They're having a tough time. My immediate thought when Notre Dame was ranked number one last week was honestly like, duh. Like, they've beaten all of these teams. They've remained undefeated in ACC play, which isn't a tough thing to do. So I respect that. And then NC State, a team that has been to Final Fours the last few years, who Isaiah James last year was in a Final Four and was lethal from three. I'm like, yeah, at this point in the season, they've been playing together for so long. They've got chemistry. They feel good. They absolutely can pull off an upset. My hot take, it's better for Notre Dame, and it's terrible for the rest of the teams that are in the top 25, that this Notre Dame team lost before going into conference. I think that even though there were some questionable calls and NC State had to score 104 points, like triple digits, two overtimes, like everybody's tired at that point, I still think that the Irish will learn the lessons that they need to not make the same mistakes in March. I feel like this type of loss right before the end of conference play almost helps them more than it hurts them. That's my hot take.
I love that. And the one thing, Caroline, I will tweak one word to what you said, because I think you're 1,000% right. But I think there's a lot of people in society that hear parity and they think average, mediocrity. So like parity a lot of times means in the NFL, it means you've got teams that are all 9-8 or 8-9, right? And for years, there's been plenty of women's college basketball that has been mired under that. I think what we're seeing is a rise of excellence from a dozen programs. And so what's really cool to watch is that you legitimately now have an NCAA tournament bracket world. For years, you could just look at it and say, all right, I'm picking UConn, you're picking South Carolina, we'll see who's right. Like, you just get away with that. I think right now, as we sit going into this late in the season, not a single one of us has a damn clue who's going to win the women's championship. And that is the best thing, right? Like, that is the, you want to tell me any combination, because you've laid out 8 or 9 teams that I think have a very legitimate shot at a national championship. You lay out any combination of those for the Final Four, and you're going to talk about some of the best women's college basketball we've ever seen. And that's why I think what's amazing is this rise of excellence. What I want to see in the tournament, I'm usually a guy that loves total chaos. You guys know that. I'm an agent of chaos. I want everything to blow up. Not in this situation. I want to see this excellence get as deep into this run as possible, because the great moment for women's college basketball still is reminding everybody, hey, this is not just Caitlin's sport. Like, this is the next generation. We're going to talk a little bit about some of these best players. Best players shine in the tournament. Best teams, best players, all advancing for the women's tournament is such a huge opportunity to continue educating people that aren't paying attention to the fact that the game is getting absolutely unbelievable. Like, high-level women's college basketball right now, I think, is better than high-level WNBA basketball. It is. There's an environment around it. There's a matchup to it. It's just the camera work going to Mulkey's face when she doesn't like the shot that's hit on
that
her team. Like,
so
these
good.
Are the moments. Like, these are the moments, and they will capture us all. Like, I am so just excited about the fact that there are that many championship level teams this year.
I just know that Kim Mulkey's children are like, I've seen that face so many times. Didn't make my bed, didn't do my chores. And she gave you that same kind of grimace that you saw on the sidelines against Kentucky. But I'm glad you pointed that out, Fitz, that it's not parody just because, well, okay, somebody has to win it at the end of this. No, it is parody of excellence. I mean, look at the top 10. UConn sitting at number 5 goes on the road and snaps South Carolina's 71 home game winning streak. But UConn also got beat by number 11 Tennessee, who got beat by number 7 LSU, who got beat by number 1 Texas, and you have UCLA sitting at number 2, and their only loss in the season came on the road at number 4 USC. It's just, to your point, Ice, they've all beaten up on each other, that if you could tell me, you know, fast forward to the end of the women's tournament, that any of those teams would be the eventual champion, I'd say, okay, makes sense. If you tell me that NC State is the eventual champion sitting right inside the top 10, I would say, okay, I believe you. If you told me Kentucky at number 15 with Georgia Amore as their legitimate star, that they would be the eventual NCAA champion, I'd say, okay, yeah, I believe you, which makes this game so incredibly fun. And it's not just, because I do think sometimes that parody can be a little bit boring for fans, that fans might fall in love with that one elite team at the top. I think fans, at least I can speak for myself, have fallen in love with the fact that there is not just one single superstar, as fun as that is in this game. There are so many superstars, whether it's Madison Booker at Texas or Lauren Betts at UCLA or Juju Watkins at USC, Hannah Hidalgo at Notre Dame. I can go on and on and on. There are so many characters to root for in the women's game, Fitz.
I mean, like, and to that point, Caroline, I was sitting in a sports bar in Connecticut on Saturday when the women's team just absolutely, I mean, they were up by 40, right? Like, they were crushing them. And if anyone's ever been to a sports bar in Connecticut, inevitably, every time they play, somebody screams, UConn, and somebody else goes, Huskies, and it's just the whole bar going over and over and over. And a guy next to me, like, a diehard fan, and I looked at him at one point, I was like, the craziest thing to me is that this UConn team is about to win by 40, and I can't tell you with any assurance that they are a national championship team this year. I can tell you they're one of the contenders, but I can tell you that this year, most years when you see, oh, UConn beat somebody by 40, you roll your eyes, you're like, here we go again. It's like, okay, they beat that team by 40. If I, as a person that dabbles in the gambling world, I'm not comfortable betting on it. Like, I'm not comfortable giving anybody my money right now for who I think is going to win the Natty, because I think we genuinely have to see how the bracket comes out to figure out how these matchups are going to work. And that's wild when you have that level of dominance, but there are so many teams that can pull that off.
The last thing I'll say to add on to both of your fantastic points is literally that also these top 10 teams have fantastic retention. We're not looking at a Hannah Hidalgo last year that was with NC State and then is now in her first year at Notre Dame. No, she's been there for 2 years. Juju has been at USC. Paige has been always at UConn. South Carolina with their depth. They had the same players since last year. Like LSU, Kim Mulkey, kept Flage. We're seeing, too, that retention allows some of these teams to continue their level of excellence because they stay in their programs, they stay put, they have stability, and now they're just getting better year after year. I think that's a really cool thing, too. That doesn't happen as much on the men's side, but on the women's side, it's a clear factor in the top 10. Everybody was there in their schools last year.
It's a great point. I'll even add, because the hitch in your argument could be, okay, well, Georgia Amor has brought Kentucky women's basketball into a top of the conversation. But Georgia Amor also followed Kenny Brooks, her coach from Virginia Tech, to Kentucky. So it's not like she just left. Like, she wanted to stay with her coach. So in a way, that is retention, at least for Kenny Brooks. And then adding her on top of all of the talent that was already in Lexington, that's just the perfect recipe for Kentucky not being a top 15 team and a team that can make some noise in the NCAA tournament. This is the perfect point to break as we're talking about all of these superstars in the women's game right now, because one of the huge discussion points isn't just, okay, which team can win a national championship. It's a lot of them. It's also the Women's Player of the Year race, which might have just as much parity and as much discussion as the eventual national champion. We'll get into that coming up next here on the College Basketball Power Hour. I think every year around, let's say, NFL MVP voting or Heisman time, it brings up the conversation of what does that award mean to you? Is NFL MVP the best player on the best team? Is NFL MVP the most important player to their team's success? Same thing with a Heisman, same thing with players of the year. And the reason why I bring that up is because I think what you find important and what you think that these awards truly mean can kind of show your train of thought of who you think should be MVP, Heisman Trophy winner, and in this case, the Women's College Basketball Player of the Year. There are five nominees that I think we can kind of rank through here in our Power Hour Power Rankings. Right now, Juju Watkins at USC has the best odds to win Player of the Year, at least on BetMGM, followed by Paige Beckers, Hannah Hidalgo, Lauren Betts, and we'll throw Zoe Brooks in there from NC State, who had an absolutely massive 33-point and 10-rebound game against number one Notre Dame in that big upset. Fitz, I'll start with you. Who would be your front runner, at least right now, for Women's Player of the Year, and why?
Well, look, I think it's Juju. I think I want to say Juju's done everything that you could ask, and part of this is the growth in Juju's game. I love Ice pointing out players in the last segment. You know, players stick around, you know, and they play together. There's some element of this to see Juju go from as dominant as she was, but then to be better in every statistical category this year. The one thing I do want to say, though, I think sometimes in basketball in general, men's and women's, we normalize greatness. So remember the first time that we ever saw a player average, when Russ averaged a triple-double for the season, and everybody lost their minds. And the next year, he averages again, and we're like, I don't know, we've seen that. You know, that's what we do. Like, just this is how we treat the sport. And I only say that because I'm a little biased to the fact that I'm in Connecticut. I watch a lot of Paige Beckers. She's one of the most dominant players I think we've forgotten about in modern college basketball. Like, it's amazing to me sometimes to watch Paige play and realize, like, injuries are part of this conversation. But I covered Paige her freshman year at ESPN. And we all thought at the time she was going to do what Caitlin did, right? And then it just feels like Caitlin had this massive ascension, Paige got hurt, and we've sort of lost on it. Like, the fact that I think it's Juju, but the only thing I'd say is that I don't want to sleep on the greatness of what Paige offers for UConn. That's all.
And no, it's tough because, like Caroline said, it's like important how you go into it. Like, what's your perspective? With some of these players, you know, because Hannah Hidalgo, Juju Watkins were only sophomores last year. They're only sophomores this year. And so then we're talking about National Player of the Year candidates that are only sophomores, that have only played 2 years of college basketball. Both of them have had tremendous games all season. I think the thing for me about Paige, and maybe this is just, and we as a basketball community have very high expectations for the UConn Huskies. If they don't win a national championship, it seems like it was a bust. You know, like, I'm sorry. It's, like, unfair because they, you know, have a dynasty and have won the most ever. And my goodness, like, you just feel like Geno can't lose. But then when you look at the calendar and you're like, hey, they haven't won a national championship since 2016. Then you're like, well, what's going on? And then you we've had 4 years of Paige, and absolutely she has weathered all of the injuries. But now you're just kind of like, hey, you need to go and win a national championship in order to make me a believer that Paige Bueckers is on the same level that a Maya Moore, a Breanna Stewart, a Nafisa Collier have been in terms of talking about UConn greats. And there's a whole plenty list more that I could talk about, but we don't have all day here. On the other side, though, for Juju, I think it's been, you know, she's been coined as a generational talent. And when you see her drop 38 points, 11 rebounds, and 8 blocks versus the number one team in the country and beat UCLA, it's like, how can you not call her a generational talent? How can you not respect what she's doing right now? And you mentioned it, Fitz, that she's grown in her game. I think the most important thing for me, for Juju, was her maturity and not always needing to take tough shots. Yes, you can make them. And yes, they look great and they're on highlight reels. But we all know that down the stretch of games, the actual most important thing is getting a great shot, getting a high percentage look without having to score over 3 people. I think her assist numbers are better this year, which is important because they've added other pieces that need to score and facilitate for her. I also will really say that I love Hannah Hidalgo. I've said it time and time before that she's the most competitive player in college basketball. She's like a shark smelling blood in the water every possession with the way in which she plays defense and defends. And oftentimes the smallest player on the court, 5'5", 5'6", but she makes all the difference defensively. She's been second in the ACC in scoring and second in the country in scoring. I feel like those three have kind of shared a lot of the spotlight. And then Caroline, we would be remiss if we didn't mention Lauren Betts at UCLA. I mean, it's a team that was, you know, number one for several weeks, and she's the 6'7" force inside that practically no one can stop scoring inside.
Can you win a MVP type award playing that style? Like, because we are so in love with dynamic play.
We are. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm a guard, so I'm partial to my guards, especially when guards also defend, like their life depends on it too, right? I'm not about the guards that just score, 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 and that's all you do. No. Like, you need to play both sides of the basketball for me to think that you're National Player of the Year candidate. I will say, though, that we probably need to give post players more love because of the post players that she is dominating against in Big Ten play and has done in non-conference play. I think you can win with Lauren Betts inside. And UCLA earned a number one seed for a good amount of time this season because of her play inside and because of how she's a deterrence on the inside as well. I just have a little more love for my guards. And we're just going to acknowledge my bias now that's just how I am.
I love that. I love every ounce of acknowledgement. And look, this comes back to what we talked about. Like, part of the difficulty in these decisions is there's just so much dynamic play. And I think we also have to acknowledge that I love the way you talked about expectations, because this happens in every sport. Frank Schwab on Inside Coverage on the NFL show that I'm part of pointed out years ago that he wishes he could go back in time to whoever invented the term MVP. He knows the name of the guy. I don't. And just say, don't do it. Like, just make the award best player, because I don't think what anybody understood at the time is that MVP becomes a very nuanced conversation. Best player is a lot easier to identify. And one of the difficult things about MVP in this situation is we have certain expectations. Like, Juju was so good last year that she was immediately anointed the future of women's college basketball, rightfully so for how she plays. But that changes the way we absorb her entire season this year. Like, there's this heightened expectation. You mentioned Paige, and I think it's a great point. They haven't won a natty with her. So, like, and all of these other conversations from what we expected from her become part of how we judge her today. So I think one of the interesting things about Hannah particularly is that she didn't walk into this season with that same level of, like, you, this is who you got to be and this is what we got to see. So now everybody's fallen in love with it because we didn't expect it to be what it is this year. So, like, it's just amazing to me how what we perceived 3 months ago, it's impossible as human beings not to let that impact how we see the game today.
And correct me if I'm completely off base here. And I know I'm playing revisionist history, but just play with me for a second. If UCLA goes on the road to USC and beats USC, let's say UCLA is still an undefeated team and is still the number one team in all the land, are we having this discussion? Or is Lauren Betts kind of the hands-down player of the year because she is the best player on the best team, the number one team, and the only undefeated team in the country? Is it fair of us, and look, I know sports aren't fair, but is it fair of us to kind of just throw her to the end of this conversation and focus in on Paige Beckers and Juju Watkins and Hannah Hidalgo only because UCLA has lost one game on the road to a top five team in the country?
When you put it like that, Caroline, it's not fair. You're absolutely right. I think, and let's be honest too, like, let's put some stats behind Lauren Betts. She shoots 61% from the field. For the majority of the season, she was top three in the country in field goal percentage, shooting like 64-65%, which is what she shot last year, 64. So we talk about, like, immediate buckets, high percentage looks. There's a different level of high percentage when you're throwing the ball into Lauren Betts one-on-one on the post. There are tremendous pieces around Lauren Betts in UCLA, which I also think sometimes hurts you in the National Player of the Year conversation when you've got better pieces around you. Stick with me here, because then you have a Kiki Rice and you're kind of like, ooh, well, you also have a very good two guard. So your team is number one, not just because you're number one. Not that USC doesn't have good pieces, but I think that Juju is a bigger piece than Lauren Betts is on her UCLA team. I think you can make an argument either way. Kiki Ryuffin is terrific for USC. They've got some nice freshman pieces around. But I think sometimes when you have better pieces around you, it kind of waters down your what your National Player of the Year award should be, because you're on a top five team. Yet you've got other signature pieces around. Hannah Hidalgo and Notre Dame is the exact same way. You look at the whole starting five, I think all of them are like top 10 in categories across the country. Points per game, rebounds, assists, steals. Like, it's ridiculous. She's got so much help. I feel like if the Irish don't win a national championship, it's going to be a bust. Like, for real. But I think that's why Juju is so spectacular, because you can't necessarily say that about all the other pieces around her. And you know that she is the focal point. If Juju doesn't have a good game, USC is not having a good game. I don't think the same can be said about other teams.
That is really well said. And I'd add Paige to that, by the way. Paige obviously has superstars next to her. There's no doubt about
that.
Yep. Let me, though, throw one other thing into Hannah's, like, bucket. If we're sitting here making these buckets of like, Hannah, while she's on a very good team, Hannah's team has handled some of these other people that we're talking about. Like, we straight up, we have the result. Like, there is no question. Notre Dame has beaten USC. Notre Dame has beaten UConn. Like, Notre Dame has beaten these teams this year. So if I'm Hannah, I'm looking around saying, hey, look, I am one of, if not the best players in the world, and my team may be stacked around me, but I've beaten all the other women that you're talking about right now. One, like, my team, their team, I walked out the victor. That's got to count somewhere in the bucket of value for an MVP.
I think it absolutely should.
I couldn't agree more.
But this is what I think the difference is, and why I think if I had a vote, I don't, but if I did, I would vote for Juju Watkins, and why I think Juju Watkins will eventually be the Wooden Award winner, the Women's Player of the Year. Big-time players make big-time plays, in big time games. Hannah Hidalgo's team in Notre Dame was the number one team in the nation. The first game they played, they lost to NC State. Juju Watkins took on the number one team in the country and had 38 points and 11 rebounds, 8 blocks, 5 assists, and shot 6 for 9 from 3 against the number one team in the country. One of the biggest games of the entire season, UCLA at USC, Juju Watkins stole the show. And USC and UCLA still have yet to play for the second time this year. Maybe that game comes down to not just the Big Ten regular season championship, not just a number one overall seed, but also who was going to win player of the year. Lauren Betts, Juju Watkins. That's going to be one of the best storylines as we get into the postseason. But Juju Watkins stepped up big time in the biggest game of the year at that point. And that's ultimately what I think is going to push her over the edge. She had the biggest performance, the best performance in the biggest game. Paige Bueckers had a good game against South Carolina, but it was AZ Fudd who really stole the show. When all eyes were on UConn in a big-time matchup, Paige Bueckers didn't have that same kind of dominant Juju Watkins performance that she had against UCLA. So I think ultimately that could be the difference, what you do in these big-time games.
Yeah, I think back to what Gino Auriemma said about Paige Bueckers a couple of weeks ago after they lost to Tennessee before that South Carolina win. And he said, you know, Paige loves to have the ball in her hands until she's double teamed, until she's triple teamed, late game. And then it's like, what are we doing? And if I'm really being honest on this pod as a basketball analyst, we've seen that Paige Bueckers before. Last year, Final Four, this time last year, we saw that team get to a Final Four, she get double teamed, and then we didn't see the killer instinct Paige that we wanted to see. Juju doesn't have that. Juju, almost to a fault, is going to shoot the basketball to make the game-winning play, even if she's quadruple teamed, because she knows that that's the expectation that she has as a generational talent to make it happen. I think half of it is mindset. I certainly think that that game, USC and UCLA, is going to be the ultimate measuring stick for these teams getting to the Final Four. It's also very tough to play a top three team twice in conference play. But I love whoever was in the Big Ten and was like, nah, we need this. We need them to play twice. And they gave us a little gift.
Stir the pot even more.
As a show, if there, we get the vote, the three of us. Are we making Juju one?
I think Juju
one and Hannah two. Is that kind of where we are in this?
Yeah, we did ride pretty hard for Hannah Fitz. I feel like you did too. I'm not mad at it.
Like, I'm not mad at a Juju one, Hannah two, and then, I mean, we could take it either way. Like, we could take Lauren and three and Paige at four. Like, I think that's sort of our conversation.
Is coming. It's Paige four.
I think so. I think so. I think they've got the edge over Paige. I mean, it's close, but I think right now, going into the end of regular season, that would be my Mount Rushmore of National Player of the Year candidates. I like that. Good job, team. Look at us.
I came in ready to push for Paige, and by the end of it, I'm like, no, y'all are right. Paige is four. So there we go.
Isn't that crazy? And it goes along with kind of the theme of the day of how much talent there is on the women's side, that Paige Bueckers, who is I hate that we throw around the term generational talent, but I'm going to use it for Paige Bueckers. Generational talent, one of the faces of the game, going to be a top three, top five, if not the number one pick in the WNBA draft at UConn, a place that has the richest history of women's basketball than any other program in the country. And she's fourth in at least our college basketball Power Hour MVP rankings. Like that just goes to show.
These are official college basketball Power Hour.
Give you one more. And the fact that she's in her fifth year as a senior, the oldest on the list, and everybody else is younger and still growing. Scary hours out here.
Mm-hmm.
Wild. Absolutely wild. All right, we'll take a quick break here. What we're watching this week coming up next. All right, before we get to Fitz's sit down with Alex Caravan, UConn forward, first, let's get into what we are watching this week. I'll start it off with what I think is probably the most obvious of the week. It's USC and UCLA. Like, that's duh. Like, it's the most obvious thing that we all are watching in the women's side of the game. UCLA went to USC. They lost their only loss in the season. Now USC turns around, goes on the road 14 whole miles away from USC's campus to go to UCLA. These two teams hate each other. These two schools hate each other. These two teams have some of the richest history in basketball, men's and women's, in sports as a whole. Like, there's just so much there. And then you add on top of the fact that this game likely decides the Big Ten regular season. I'm eating all of the USC and UCLA matchup and all of the drama and all of the pomp and circumstance that comes with it. But what are you watching?
Oh, yeah. I honestly can't wait to watch that one. I'll be right there with you, probably texting in the group chat as Juju or Lauren Betts goes off, whatever one happens first. For me on the women's side, another rivalry game, UNC and Duke. It's happening on Thursday. This is after UNC women's basketball, number 8, top 10 in the country. We talked about those teams who look like a top 10 team. They feel like that. I really like the Tar Heels. And then Duke dropped a couple of games recently. They lost 2 in a row and bounced back this weekend versus Syracuse. I had that game actually on the CW. They literally crushed my orange. They crushed the orange by like 39 points. It was not fun for me, but a good game to call. And then on the men's side, Bama and Tennessee. I mean, we keep talking about these games that you get as the regular season is winding down. Those teams are 5 and 6 in the top 10 on the men's side. What an awesome opportunity for either team just to solidify where they are and get some confidence. I think confidence is a thing that around this time of year, I also love to talk about because you're playing against teams that maybe you don't know, you don't have history between, and you're just trying to, at least in March Madness, you're just trying to win the way you know how. And so these games right at the end of regular season really solidify a team's confidence in saying, okay, we feel like we can beat anybody if we're Tennessee and we go get this win versus Bama or vice versa. So two really good games coming up.
On that Bama-Tennessee game too, like you better have your legs, you better have your focus. Like this late into the season for the SEC, it feels like there's never a break. There's not a gap game. There's just not a gimme. And I'm genuinely curious to see what the required focus is going to mean for teams as they go down the stretch. Like as they get into the tournament, are teams exhausted or are they just so mentally sharp that it helps them? I don't think we'll know until we get into it. That game's going to be wild. I'll pick another men's game that I have my eye on. The second straight week I'm sitting here talking about Michigan State. But Wisconsin looked like they were going to just absolutely destroy Oregon and then they fell apart. And it's interesting to me to see how they rebound from that because, as we've already talked about, I feel like Sparty right now has a ton of momentum. Wisconsin is playing for seeding, and seeding is going to matter in this tournament. They're a very good team, obviously. But these two teams, at this point, Michigan State has turned around whatever that little hiccup was. They're playing really well. This is a statement moment for Wisconsin because we talk about teams that are about to get a bunch of hype. If Michigan State beats down Wisconsin the way that they can, then we're going to start having a real conversation about where Michigan State lies in the national championship, you know, level. But for Wisconsin, they're trying to prove to everybody exactly where they fit in this tournament. And I think a lot of people watched the first half of that Oregon game and they were ready to make a definitive statement about Wisconsin. And then you watch the second half and you're like, nope, same old Wisconsin. So, like, I do think they have to break through some of that, especially against a conference rival that's playing really well.
And that's the eye test, right? I mean, that's just simply passing the eye test. Yeah, Fitz, they could drop the game. I mean, Wisconsin could lose the game to Michigan State. But depending on how they lose and how it looks to the NCAA committee, you could earn spots in seeding because you were able to keep up with them and because maybe you were so mature during the course of the game. So I think for teams this year, this time of year too, like, you got to pass the eye test. Yes, we're looking at records, but we're also looking at, do you look like you deserve to have a top 5 seed in the NCAA tournament? Do you look like you're a team that shouldn't have to travel far from home and have an advantage being close by? I think the eye test is so important. And I think for Wisconsin, that's kind of what you're talking about. They need to pass that whether they win the game or not.
Isn't that a little bit of what we're dealing with A&M now? I mean, A&M now 1-5 versus top 10 teams. So everybody in that committee, when it gets to these seeding moments, are going to sit there and say, okay, I realize their record is one thing, and I realize we perceive the SEC as one thing, but how did they look? How did those games play out against top 10 teams? Like, that's going to be wild for A&M. Wisconsin and A&M are both sort of fighting for their seeding lives.
Yeah, we were talking positive about the Aggies last week. We were like, oh, they're going to be so solid. It's fine. They've been weathering storms. And then dropped two games. Lost to Texas, who's a team that'll surprise you. Oh, sorry, lost to Mississippi State, a team that will surprise you, still in the top 25. And then lost to Tennessee, which probably you expected. But still lost two games in a row.
I mean, this is a huge seeding weekend. This is also a huge bubble weekend. You talk about how you look against these really good teams. I look at Florida on the road at Georgia coming up on Tuesday. Georgia's a bubble team. Georgia obviously needs a win. A win over number 3 Florida would be enough, I think, to push Georgia into that conversation. Not put them in safely, but put them in the tournament. But even if Georgia can go toe-to-toe, if Georgia can keep this game close, I think that's a legitimate argument. So I think maybe last month was the month of like these sexy matchups of the ranked on ranked and the top 10 on top 10 on the men's side. But now it's a top 10 team, a top 15 team against a team that is fighting for their tournament lives. That is going to be where all I have to use the word juicy in today's podcast. We haven't used it yet. That's where the juicy games and the juicy matchups lie. All right. That is what we are watching this week. Let's hear from Alex Caravan, UConn forward. He was there. He experienced the highest of the highs and the greatness in the championships at UConn last season. Now, pretty up and down. Here was Fitz's sit down with UConn forward Alex Caravan.
I am hanging out with UConn superstar Alex Caravan, joining us on behalf of Powerade. Can't wait to talk to you about Powerade because we always have the debate of the best flavors. Like, this is life for us, Alex. But first, let's talk a little ball, man. Obviously, you are a back-to-back national championship team. You are aware of this. You're aware of the expectations. This year for UConn's been a little bit up and down, obviously. What's been the key, you think, this year on why things have felt so different?
Yeah, I think obviously it's tough when you go from the greatest team of all time, in my opinion, what going 37-3 last year, to losing 4 starters, losing a couple key bench players, to, you know, having to replace those guys, replacing a Donovan Kling and Steph Castle, Cam Spencer, Tristan Newton, replacing those guys. So it's always going to be tough and a learning adjustment in general, but we've been playing some great games this year, and we played some really bad games this year, and it's been a real roller coaster for us, and we're just continuing to learn every single day. We're continuing to get better, and we've showed everybody how high our ceiling can be, but we also showed how low our ceiling can be. So we got to find that balance of always being at our highest and playing a full 40-minute game.
It's interesting, though, because I remember even at the Final Four National Championship last year talking to you guys about how expectations weren't that high. People were doubting UConn last year, right? And so I think we just got used to this concept that you guys can just push through anything. How difficult has it been for you? Because now you're in this leadership role. You got to be the one that sort of pulls everybody up. What's your learning curve been like in that process?
No, it's definitely been – I've been learning every single day just because – I've been through this stretch before, whether that was my freshman year in January where we lost 6 out of 8, and I learned from Andre and Adama really just how to push through and how to stay together as a team. And I'm really trying to learn those pieces right now, as last year there was really no experience of that at all. We probably lost, we lost 3 games. So it's just learning from those games. But this year it's been a different. We've gone wins at Marquette and then losing the next game at home, or win at Creighton and losing a game to Seton Hall. So really experiencing both ends of the spectrum. So I'll just continue to give confidence to the guys every single day, continue to remind them how great of a team we can be, and just constantly remind them that we have 5 games left in the Big East and the Big East tournament. If we can win out and win the Big East tournament, it doesn't matter what happened in the past. Just get in as hot as possible heading into March Madness, and whoever has the best momentum heading into March Madness, we've seen crazier things happen in March, and UConn's got a little bit of swagger in March too, so we'll be able to showcase that.
Is there some sort of a, because for you individually, you're also trying to shoot your way out of a little bit of a slump too. How do you find that balance individually on, hey, I don't want to press, but I also want to be the guy that lifts everybody up?
Yeah, I think when I'm around the team, I'm going to continue to be who I am and be the same guys you see every single day, lifting the group up, giving each other confidence, and being that leader that the team needs to be. And then before practice or after practice, I'll have time to myself. When I'm in my room, I'll reflect on myself and continue to get my own hopes high and talk to people that I trust, whether that's my parents or the assistant coaches, Coach Hurley, and just people within my circle that can give me confidence as well. So when I'm with my team, I can't show any weaknesses and show any downfall that even though I am going through a struggling month right now, I can't let my struggles affect the team.
You mentioned Coach Hurley and you mentioned Swagger. Got to put the two of them together because we all know Coach has got his thing. What does the world not know about Coach?
I genuinely think he's the funniest person I've ever met in my life. Like just the jokes he cracks on a daily basis and just how fun of a person he is to be around and how easy it is to connect with him. And he's just such a great person. And he is passionate and intense on the sidelines and when he's on the court, but off the court, he's very chill and very like, he's a very like cool person to talk to.
What were your emotions and everybody's emotions when speculation was running rampant that he was going to become the Lakers coach? I mean, for anyone that doesn't know, the entire state of Connecticut was losing their minds. I lived there, right? So from you guys watching it go down, how were you feeling in that moment?
I was nervous just because everything we saw on Twitter or Instagram, like that's the information we got too until Coach Hurley decided to talk to us. So I was nervous, especially because I made a decision of coming back too. And then that happened. So I wanted my coach to be here selfishly and really, yeah, it was just a nervous time. But we just stuck together as a team and just, you know, no matter what happened, if he were to leave, we'd be happy for him and his family, but continue to realize that we are a team. And but when he did come back, I mean, it was the best feeling ever. Then he surprised us in the film room by saying he's coming back. And it was it was just a great moment for us.
A lot of people have a lot to say about some of the things Coach says gets caught on the mic. He's been pretty loud about, hey, I want them to pay attention to everything else, but you play for him. So what do you guys feel from his energy when he starts going off on the officials or going off on the crowd or pointing at the finger to remind him how many rings you guys get?
It gets us going. Really, everything he does or says, it gets us going. And we know right now that people don't like him a lot. And we know that because we think he keeps winning. And you kind of saw it with the Chiefs recently, too. It's like people are starting to hate on the Chiefs just because they won back to back and people didn't want them to three-peat. And, you know, we believe it's the same thing right now with Coach and our team. So he's getting a lot of hatred and it fires us up. And his energy towards the crowd and his energy towards the refs fires us up, too. And it's just exciting to play for him. And he's the best coach that you could play for.
I mean, is there pressure? Do you guys feel pressure to try and find a way to three-peat?
No, there's no pressure at all. I don't think there's pressure whatsoever. This is a completely different team. We got new players who haven't won before. We also have players that have won. But, I mean, if we don't three-peat this year, they're not going to tell us, like, oh, UConn sucks. They weren't able to three-peat. Like, you don't see it often. So there's no pressure whatsoever. And, honestly, we believe there's pressure on other people. If they're elite programs, they'd want to win a national championship, too.
It's interesting to me because I didn't know till I lived in Connecticut how important UConn basketball is, men's and women's, to this entire community. This state lives, eats, and breathes it. I mean, you're from New England, so you have an understanding of it. But like, what does UConn mean to this community? Why is there such a connection?
UConn means everything to the state of Connecticut. I mean, you see every single game is sold out for both the men's and women's sides, and you just see the passion throughout the state. You'll see UConn flags everywhere. You'll see people wearing UConn basketball gear when you're walking to class, and people just fall in love with the team. And I think, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out too why. And I think maybe it's the success that we've had, and maybe it's just how dominant both men's and women's program have been throughout the last 25, 30-ish years, even what Geno's done for his entire career. So people just fall in love with that. People love seeing us win, and they hold us to such a high standard to when we're not, I'm speaking for the men's team right now, when we're not playing at the level that we should be playing at, the fans will let us know just because they care so much and they want to see UConn succeed.
The love of basketball, though, I mean, you do. Let's talk about the girls for a second, because the women, that program is absolutely incredible. What's it like for you guys just sharing facilities and being around it and seeing the greatness of some of the individuals and that team overall?
It's amazing. It's just a blessing to be in the same facility as them, whether it's with Coach Geno or seeing the level of players they have, such as Paige and AZ, and just seeing their work ethic every single day. And it gets us going as well, too, just seeing how successful they are, because we want to be as successful as them, too. And seeing what Gino's done, winning 11 national championships. And anytime you see him, you want to talk to him, you want to learn from him. And they just want as much success as we do too. So it's just motivating. It's just motivating each other and just has great balance in the facility.
So you're joining us on behalf of Powerade. I'm excited about this. Look, Connecticut's known for pizza and wings, and nothing washes all of that down better than Powerade. Like, so what are you doing with Powerade, and what's the go-to flavor? Come on now.
Yeah, so I'm doing a campaign with them right now, and Powerade first introduced this campaign for the March Madness season, and their slogan really for it is, it takes more, and that's something I've just felt fits our team as well too. It takes more, and if we want to three-peat and we want to get through this roller coaster of a season we're having, it's just going to take more from everybody, and it just resonates with me. And UConn's also a Powerade school, so after every workout I'm going to the fridge and I just naturally pick up a blue or a purple Powerade, you know, it's mountain berry or grape. So really it's always just been around ever since I was a freshman. So when Powerade gave me this opportunity, I knew I had to take it. And my favorite Powerade, I'm going to go with grape. But lately, it's been melon and strawberry lemonade.
The grape is the grape is my go-to. But I got to give you credit. Like, my favorite part about this is that we just identify by color. Like, the fact that it's like, I like the purple. Like, we don't even think of flavors anymore. We just go straight to the color. All right. So is that, like, for your teammates, do you feel like that's the go-to flavor? Is there one teammate that drinks a really weird Powerade to you? Or do you make any weird combos?
So I haven't had... Our managers, actually, they mix Powerades together for practice. So we used to just do we used to do Mountain Berry and we used to do Grape, like, separately for practice, like one day Mountain Berry, one day Grape. They started mixing it. And then now, ever since I partnered with Powerade, we just been trying all these different flavors. And they sent flavors I never even knew existed, like Melon, Island Burst, and a Strawberry Lemonade. And that's all my teammates ask for now. So I tell my agent, like, look, whenever Powerade wants to send something, just send us Melon, Island Burst, and Strawberry Lemonade, because we don't really see those often, and they just love them. And we probably get like 8 boxes of Powerade, and they're gone in 5 days. I'm not exaggerating. It's unbelievable how much my teammates just be selfish with my Powerade.
Yeah, well, all I'm saying is next time I'm at stores, I'm just going to wave at you. You can throw me one, man. I appreciate your time. Congrats on a great career so far. Can't wait to see what happens. Can't wait to see if the three-peat can become a reality for you. But most importantly, congrats on kicking butt for a long time and congrats on everything with Powerade. We appreciate you, brother.
Thank you so much.
All right, Fitz, what'd you take away from your conversation with Alex?
I'm going to go back to something I said earlier about leadership. And I just think we presume as a society that I've been here a few years, it's now my time, I will step up and be the leader. I think you can see some of that struggle from Alex. Like, he's not shooting well, he's got to figure out his own game, and he's got to lead a bunch of young guys that are trying to figure out the culture over and overall. And I think we overuse that word and concept sometimes, but man, I kept looking at it thinking, it makes me appreciate the skill of leadership, because I'm not sure, just because you're next up and anointed doesn't mean that you are that person in that way that knows how to get the pulse of every person in the locker. I think the toughest thing about being great in a locker room is acknowledging that there are so many different personalities that are motivated in so many different ways, and really translating yourself to them to get the best out of everybody around you. It's a huge burden for some people. And I even felt in talking to Alex, like, Alex is a fun guy. I've interviewed him 4 or 5 times in my career. It doesn't feel like he has that same levity right now. It feels like the weight of leadership at UConn has weighed him down to me.
I mean, communicating effectively is what we need leaders to do, right? When you're the point guard on the floor and you hear about, you know, this player is an extension of the coach, it's because they communicate effectively to everyone. That pressure that exists in winning back-to-back national championships, and then everyone expecting your team to try and do what we've never seen in a three-peat, right? That pressure is a ton. And the leadership part is tough. I think what he talked about was interesting, that he said basically that to his team, he can't come inadequate, right? That to his team, he needs to be on point, the same. It's a high standard. And then maybe to his coaches or people outside of the team, he can maybe come as his real self, where maybe if he's feeling down, struggling with confidence, he gets it from them. To put on that face and to put on that type of front for your team day in and day out, playing under Dan Hurley and the expectations that he has for you as a leader, that's tremendous. I mean, I'm not sure I had a teammate during my 7 years of playing college basketball that had those type of pressures, but that also felt like to the team, they couldn't come and say, hey guys, I'm having a down day. Like Alex was like, I can't do that. I can't afford to have those type of days with this team because they rely on me so much. I also will say on the other tip, one thing that I took away from what he said was that all of the Dan Hurley antics is funny to him. He says he's one of the funniest people he knows. Yeah. He says he gets energy from that guy and he gets passion. And I have played for my fair share of head coaches who are animated. I had a coach, guys, I never forget. If we went on a run and got stops defensively and the other team called a timeout, he would get in like a low squat and like stomp and walk out step by step. And he'd be clapping his hands. And it would look so weird. Like it would look like an alligator walk, but like kind of I'm coming at you. But every time our team would laugh first and then get hyped second. Because we would be like, every time we saw that stomp, that means that we're going on a run. The other team is about to lay down and we got these guys. And so I also love to hear that perspective from Alex. Like the rest of y'all might call it crazy. The rest of you might see it as distractions. But to us, it gets us fired up. And that's the most important thing. Who cares what the rest of the world looks like? As long as it's cool within your culture, then rock with it.
That was one of my big takeaways too, Ice, because we look at some of these college basketball coaches that have loud and big and maybe even controversial personalities. Rick Pitino, Bruce Pearl, Kim Mulkey, Dan Hurley is probably at the top of that list. But those are very good and very accomplished coaches that have won a lot of games and that have won championships. They know what their teams need to keep them dialed in, to keep them motivated. So as long as Dan Hurley's, you know, throwing his arms around and cussing at people and cussing at the refs and saying, no, you don't turn your back on me, that might to us on the outside look like, whoa, dude, like calm down. Like this guy needs to take a little bit of a chill pill and you're at like an 11, bring it down to like a 7. Their teams, their athletes, that locker room probably gets energized by that. And so I was so glad to hear that from him. I probably didn't expect anything different, but for him to say like, no, we love him. We think he's hilarious. And when there were all of the Laker rumors, he got really nervous of, okay, what does my future look like without Coach Hurley? I thought that was awesome. Awesome to hear. All right. That is going to do it for us this week. On the College Basketball Power Hour, he is Jason Fitz. You can follow him at Jason Fitz. She's Ice Young at IceYoung23. And you can find me on Twitter at CarolineFenton1. Always appreciate y'all stopping by the podcast, interacting with the podcast. So give it a like, give it a subscribe, give it a review. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell anyone to watch this USC-UCLA matchup on March 1st. It's going to be an absolute blast.
Hell yeah.
We're out this week.